35. Confusion. 300 spacecraft retreating in Hyperion space under heavy fire, falling back from the swarm like men fighting bees. Madness near the military Farcaster portals, traffic control overloaded, ships backed up like EMVs in TC Squared's airborne gridlock, vulnerable as partridges to the roaming ouster assault ships. Madness at the exit points. 4 spacecraft lined up like sheep in a narrow pen as they cycle from the Madya cutoff portal to the outgoing caster. Ships spinning down into Hebron space, a few translating to Heaven's Gate, God's Grove, Mare Infinitus, Asquith. Only hours left now before the swarms enter web systems. Confusion, as hundreds of millions of refugees, far cast away from the threatened worlds, stepping into cities and relocation centers, gone half mad with the aimless excitement of incipient war. Confusion as unthreatened web worlds ignite with riots. 3 hives on Lucis, almost 70 million citizens, quarantined due to Shrike cult riots. 30 level malls looted, apartment monoliths overrun by mobs, fusion centers blown, Farcaster Terminexes under attack. The Home Rule Council appeals to the hegemony. The hegemony declares martial law and sends force marines to seal the hives. Secessionist riots on New Earth and Maui Covenant. Terrorist attacks from Glennon Height Royalists, quiet now for 3/4 of a century, on Thalia, Armagast, Nordholm, and Li 3. More Shrike cult riots on Tsingtao, Siswang Pana, and Renaissance Vector. Force Command on Olympus transfers combat battalions from transports returning from Hyperion to web worlds. Demolition squads assigned to torch ships in threatened systems report Farcaster singularity spheres wired for destruction, awaiting only the fat-lined order from TC Squared.
There is a better way, Counselor Albedo tells Gladstone in the War Council. The CEO turns toward the ambassador from the Techno Corps. There is a weapon that will eliminate the ousters without harming hegemony property. Or ouster property, for that matter. General Morpurgo glowers.
You're talking about the bomb equivalent of a death wand, he says. It won't work. Force researchers have shown that it propagates indefinitely. Besides being dishonorable, against the new Bushido Code, it would wipe out planetary populations as well as the invaders.
Not at all, says Albedo. If hegemony's citizens are properly shielded, there need be no casualties whatsoever. As you know, death wands can be calibrated for specific cerebral wavelengths. So could a bomb based on the same principle. Livestock, wild animals, even other anthropoid species would not be affected.
General Van Zyte of Force Marines stands.
But there's no way to shield a population. Our testing showed that death bomb heavy neutrinos would penetrate solid rock or metal to a depth of 6 kilometers. No one has shelters like that.
The projection of Counselor Albedo folds his hands on the table.
We have 9 worlds with shelters which would hold billions, he says softly.
Gladstone nods. The labyrinthine worlds, she whispers. But certainly such a transfer of population would be impossible.
No, says Albedo. Now that you have joined Hyperion to the Protectorate, each of the labyrinthine worlds has Farcaster capability. The Corps can make arrangements to transfer populations directly to these underground shelters.
There is babble around the long table, but Maynard Gladstone's intense gaze never leaves Albedo's face. She beckons for silence and receives it.
Tell us more, she says. We are interested.
The consul sits in the spotty shade of a low Neville tree and waits to die. His hands are tied behind him with a twist of fiber plastic. His clothes are torn to rags and are still damp. The moisture on his face is partially from the river, but mostly from perspiration. The 2 men who stand over him are finishing their inspection of his duffel bag.
Shit, says the first man. There be nothing worth anything herein except this fucking antique pistol.
He thrusts Braun Lamia's father's weapon in his belt.
It be too bad we couldn't get that goddamn flying carpet, says the second man.
It bain't flying too well there toward the end, says the first man, and both of them laugh.
The consul squints at the two massive figures, their armored bodies made silhouettes by the lowering sun. From their dialect, he assumes them to be indigenes. From their appearance, bits of outmoded force body armor, heavy multi-purpose assault rifles, tatters of what once had been camu polymer cloth. He guesses them to be deserters from some Hyperion self-defense force unit. From their behavior toward him, he is sure that they are going to kill him. At first, stunned from the fall into the Hooli River, still tangled in the ropes connecting him to his duffel bag and the useless hawking mat, he thought them to be his saviors. The consul had hit the water hard, stayed under for a much longer time than he would have imagined possible without drowning, and surfaced only to be pushed under by a strong current, and then pulled under again by the tangle of ropes and mat. It had been a valiant but losing battle, and he was still 10 meters from the shallows when one of the men, emerging from the Nevelin thorn tree forest, had thrown the consul a line. Then they had beaten him, robbed him, tied him, and, judging from their matter-of-fact comments, were now preparing to cut his throat and leave him for the harbinger birds. The taller of the two men, his hair a mass of oiled spikes, squats in front of the consul and pulls a ceramic zero-edge knife from its scabbard.
"Any last words, Pops?"
The consul licks his lips. He has seen 1,000 movies and hollies, where this was the point at which the hero twisted his opponent's legs out from under him, kicked the other one into submission, seized a weapon and dispatched both, firing with his hands still tied, and then went on with his adventures. But the consul feels like no hero. He is exhausted and middle-aged and hurt from his fall in the river. Each of these men is leaner, stronger, faster, and obviously meaner than the consul ever has been. He has seen violence, even committed violence once. But his life and training have been devoted to the tense but quiet paths of diplomacy. The consul licks his lips again and says, "I can pay you." The crouching man smiles and moves the zero-edge blade back and forth, 5 centimeters in front of the consul's eyes.
"With what, Pops? We've got your universal card, and it bay worth shit out here."
"Gold," says the consul, knowing that this is the only syllable that has held its power over the ages. The crouching man does not react. There is a sick light in his eyes as he watches the blade, but the other man steps forward and sets a heavy hand on his partner's shoulder.
"What bay you talking about, man? Wherefore you got gold?"
"My ship," says the consul. "The Benares." The crouching man raises the blade next to his own cheek.
"He bay lying, Chez. The Benares bay that old flat-bottom manta-pulled barge belonging to the Blueskins we finished trade day ago."
The consul closes his eyes for a second, feeling the nausea in him but not surrendering to it. A. Betic and the other android crewmen had left the Benares in one of the ship's launches less than a week earlier, heading downstream toward freedom. Evidently they had found something else. "A. Betic," he says. "The crew captain. He didn't mention the gold?" The man with the knife grins.
"He make lots of noise, but he don't speak much. He say the boat way and the shit gone up to edge. Too fucking far for a barge with no mantas, me think."
"Shut up, Obim."
The other man crouches in front of the consul.
"Why would you have gold on that old barge, man?"
The consul raises his face. "Don't you recognize me? I was hegemony consul to Hyperion for years."
"Hey, don't be fucking with us,"
begins the man with the knife, but the other interrupts.
"Yeah, man, I remember your face on the Camp Holly when I be kid-like. So why you carrying gold upriver now when the sky be fallen, hegemony man?"
"We were heading for the shelter, Kronos Keep," says the consul, trying not to sound too eager, but at the same time grateful for each second he is allowed to live. Why, part of him thinks, you were tired of living, ready to die. Not like this, not while Saul and Rachel and the others need his help. Several of Hyperion's most wealthy citizens, he says. The evacuation authorities wouldn't allow them to transfer the bullion. So I agreed to help them store it in vaults in Kronos Keep, the old castle north of the Bridal Range, for a commission.
You be fucking crazy,
sneers the man with the knife.
Everything north of here be Shrike country now.
The consul lowers his head. There is no need to simulate the fatigue and sense of defeat he projects. So we discovered. The android crew deserted last week. Several of the passengers were killed by the Shrike. I was coming downriver by myself.
This be shit,
says the man with the knife. His eyes have that sick, distracted look again.
Just a second, says his partner.
He slaps the consul once hard.
So where be this so-called gold ship, old man?
The consul tastes blood. Upriver. Not on the river, but hidden in one of the tributaries.
Yeah,
says the knife man, setting the zero-edge blade flat against the side of the consul's neck. He will not need to slash in order to sever the consul's throat, merely rotate the blade.
I say this bay shit, and I say we bay wasting time. Just a second,
snaps the other man.
How far upriver?
The consul thinks of the tributaries he has passed in the last few hours. It is late. The sun almost touches the line of a copse of trees to the west. Just above Carla Locks, he says.
So why you be flying down on that toy-like rather than barging it?
Trying to get help, says the consul. The adrenaline has faded, and now he feels a terminal exhaustion very close to despair. There were too many bandits along the shore. The barge seemed too risky. The hawking mat was safer. The man called Chaz laughs.
Put the knife away, Obem. We be walking up it a bit, hey?
Obem leaps to his feet. The knife is still in his hand, but now the blade and the anger are aimed toward his partner.
Be you fucked, man, hey? Be your head be full of shit between ears, hey? He be lying to keep from death words flying.
Chaz neither blinks nor steps back.
Sure, he be maybe lying. Don't matter, hey? The locks they be less than half-day walk we be making anyway, hey? No boat, no gold, you cut his throat, hey? Only slow-wise, ankles up-like. They be gold, you still gets the job blade-wise. Only be rich man now, hey?
Obem teeters a second between rage and reason, turns to the side and swings the ceramic zero-edge blade at a Neville tree 8 centimeters thick through the trunk. He has time to turn back and crouch in front of the consul before gravity informs the tree that it has been severed, and the Neville falls back toward the river's edge with a crash of branches. Obem grabs the consul's still-damp shirt front.
Okay, we see what bay there, hegemony man. Talk, run, trip, stumble, and I bay slicing fingers and ears just for practice, hey?
The consul staggers to his feet, and the three of them move back into the cover of brush and low trees. The consul 3 meters behind Chaz and the same distance in front of Obem, trudging back the way he had come, moving away from the city and the ship and any chance of saving Saul and Rachel. An hour passes. The consul can think of no clever scheme once the tributaries are reached, the barge not discovered. Several times Chaz waves them into silence and hiding, once at the sound of gossamers fluttering in branches, again at a disturbance across the river. But there is no sign of other human beings, no sign of help. The consul remembers the burned-out buildings along the river, the empty huts and vacant wharves. Fear of the Shrike, fear of being left behind to the ousters in the evacuation, and months of plundering by rogue elements of the SDF have turned this area into a no-man's land. The consul concocts excuses and extensions, then discards them. His only hope is that they will walk close to the locks, where he can make a leap for the deep and rapid water there, try to stay afloat with his hands tied behind him, until he is hidden in the maze of small islands below that point. Except that he is too tired to swim, even if his arms were free, and the weapons the two men carry would target him easily, even if he had a 10-minute start among the snags and isles. The consul is too tired to be clever, too old to be brave. He thinks about his wife and son, dead these many years now, killed in the bombing of Brescia by men with no more honor than these two creatures. The consul is only sorry that he has broken his word to help the other pilgrims, sorry about that, and that he will not now see how it all comes out. Oba makes a spitting noise behind him.
Shit with this Chez, hey? What say we sit him and slit him, and help him talk a bit, hey? Then we go loanwise to the barge, if barge they be.
Chez turns, rubs sweat out of his eyes, frowns at the consul speculatively, and says,
Hey, yeah, I think maybe time-wise and quiet-wise you be right, Goyo, but leave it talkable toward the end, hey?
Sure,
grins Obam, slinging his weapon and extracting his zero edge.
Do not move, booms a voice from above.
The consul drops to his knees, and the ex-SDF bandits unsling weapons with practiced swiftness. There is a rush, a roar, a whipping of branches and dust about them. The consul looks up in time to see a rippling of the cloud-covered evening sky, lower than the clouds, a sense of mass directly above, descending. And then Chez is lifting his flechette rifle, and Obam is targeting his launcher, and then all three are falling, pitching over, not like soldiers shot, not like recoil elements in some ballistic equation, but dropping like the tree Obam had felled earlier on. The consul lands face first in dust and gravel and lies there unblinking, unable to blink. Stun weapon, he thinks, through synapses gone sluggish as old oil. A localized cyclone erupts as something large and invisible lands between the three bodies in the dust and the river's edge. The consul hears a hatch whine open, and the internal tick of repeller turbines dropping below lift critical. He still cannot blink, much less lift his head, and his vision is limited to several pebbles, a dunescape of sand, a small grass forest, and a single architect ant, huge at this distance, that seems to be taking a sudden interest in the consul's moist but unblinking eye. The ant turns to hurry the half-meter between itself and its moist prize, and the consul thinks, hurry, at the unhurried footsteps behind him. Hands under his arms, grunting, a familiar but strained voice saying,
Damn, you've put on weight.
The consul's heels drag in the dirt, bouncing over the randomly twitching fingers of Chez, or perhaps it is Obam. The consul cannot turn his head to see their faces. Nor can he see his rescuer until he is lifted, with a grunted litany of soft curses near his ear, through the starboard blister hatch of the decamouflaged skimmer into the long, soft leather of the reclining passenger seat. Governor-General Theo Lane appears in the consul's field of vision, boyish-looking, but slightly demonic-looking, too, as the hatch lowers and the red interior lamps light his face. The younger man leans over to secure crash web snaps across the consul's chest.
I'm sorry I had to stun you along with those other two.
Theo sits back, snaps his own web in place, and twitches the Omni-controller. The consul feels the skimmer shiver and then lift off, hovering a second before spinning left like a plate on frictionless bearings. Acceleration pushes the consul into his seat.
I didn't have much choice,
says Theo, over the soft internal skimmer noises.
The only weapon these things are allowed to carry are the riot control stunners, and the easiest way was to drop all three of you at lowest setting and get you out of there fast.
Theo pushes his archaic glasses higher on his nose with a familiar twitch of one finger, and turns to grin at the consul.
Old mercenary proverb. Kill 'em all and let God sort 'em out.
The consul manages to move his tongue enough to make a sound and to drool a bit on his cheek and the seat leather.
Relax a minute, says Theo.
returning his attention to the instruments and view outside.
2 or 3 minutes, and you should be talking all right. I'm staying low, flying slow, so it's about a 10-minute ride back to Keats.
Theo glances toward his passenger.
You're lucky, sir. You must have been dehydrated. Those other two wet their pants when they went down. Humane weapon, the stunner, but embarrassing if you don't have a change of pants around.
The consul tries to express his opinion of this humane weapon.
Another couple of minutes, sir, says Governor General Theo Lane,
reaching over to dab at the consul's cheek with a handkerchief.
I should warn you, it's a mite uncomfortable when the stun begins to wear off.
At that moment, someone inserts several thousand pins and needles in the consul's body.
How the hell did you find me? Asks the consul.
They are a few kilometers above the city, still flying over the Huli River. He is able to sit up, and his words are more or less intelligible, but the consul is glad that he has several more minutes before he will have to stand or walk.
What, sir? I said, how did you find me? How could you possibly know that I had come back down the Huli? CEO Gladstone fatlined me. Eyes only on the old consul at one time pad.
Gladstone? The consul is shaking his hands, trying to agitate feeling back into fingers as useful as rubber sausages.
How the hell could Gladstone possibly know that I was in trouble on the Huli River?
I left Grandmother Ceres' comlog receiver back in the valley, so I could call the other pilgrims when I got to the ship. How could Gladstone know?
I don't know, sir, but she specified your location and that you were in trouble. She even said you'd been flying a Hawking map that went down.
The consul shakes his head. This lady has resources we hadn't dreamt of, Theo.
Yes, sir.
The consul glances at his friend. Theo Lane had been Governor General of the new protectorate world of Hyperion for over a local year now. But old habits died hard, and the sir came from the 7 years Theo had served as vice consul and principal aide during the consul's years. The last time he had seen the young man, not so young now, the consul realizes. Responsibility has brought lines and wrinkles to that young face. Theo had been furious that the consul would not take over the governor-generalship. That had been a little more than a week ago. Ages and eons ago.
By the way, says the consul, enunciating each word carefully. Thank you, Theo.
The governor-general nods, apparently lost in thought. He does not ask about what the consul has seen north of the mountains, nor the fate of the other pilgrims. Beneath them the Huli widens and winds toward the capital of Keats. Far back on either side low bluffs rise, their granite slabs glowing softly in the evening light. Stands of everblues shimmer in the breeze. Theo, how did you possibly have time to come for me yourself? The situation on Hyperion must be pure madness.
It is.
Theo ordered the autopilot to take over as he turned to look at the consul.
It's a matter of hours, perhaps minutes, before the ousters actually invade.
The consul blinked. Invade? You mean land?
Exactly.
But the hegemony fleet
is in total chaos. They were barely holding their own against the swarm before the web was invaded. The web? Entire systems falling. Others threatened. Force has ordered the fleet back through their military farcasters, but evidently the ships in system have found it hard to disengage. No one gives me details, but it's obvious that the ousters have free rein everywhere except for the defensive perimeter Force has put up around the singularity spheres and the portals.
The spaceport? The consul thinks of his beautiful ship lying as glowing wreckage.
It hasn't been attacked yet, but Force has been pulling its drop ships and supply craft out as quickly as they can. They've left a skeleton force of marines behind.
What about the evacuation? Theo laughed. It was the most bitter sound the consul had ever heard from the young man.
The evacuation will consist of whatever consulate people and hegemony VIPs can fit on the last drop ship out.
They've given up trying to save the people of Hyperion.
Sir, they can't save their own people.
Word trickling down through the ambassador's fat line says that Gladstone has decided to let the threatened web worlds fall so that force can regroup, have a couple of years to create defenses while the swarms accrue time debt. My God, whispers the consul. He had worked most of his life to represent the hegemony, all the while plotting its downfall in order to avenge his grandmother's way of life. But now the thought of it actually happening. What about the Shrike? He asks suddenly, seeing the low white buildings of Keats a few kilometers ahead. Sunlight touches the hills and river like a final benediction before darkness. Theo shakes his head. There are still reports, but the ousters have taken over as the primary source of panic. But it's not in the web? The Shrike, I mean. The Governor-General gives the consul a sharp look. In the web? How could it be in the web? They still haven't allowed Farcaster portals on Hyperion, and there have been no sightings near Keats or Endymion or Port Romance, none of the larger cities. The consul says nothing, but he is thinking. My God, my betrayal was for nothing. I sold my soul to open the time tombs, and the Shrike will not be the cause of the web's fall. The ousters! They were wise to us all along. My betrayal of the hegemony was part of their plan. Listen, Theo says harshly, gripping the consul's wrist. There's a reason Gladstone had me leave everything to find you. She's authorized the release of your ship. Wonderful, says the consul. I can... Listen, you're not to go back to the Valley of the Time Tombs. Gladstone wants you to avoid the force perimeter and travel in-system until you contact elements of the swarm. The swarm? Why would... The CEO wants you to negotiate with them. They know you. Somehow she's managed to let them know that you're coming. She thinks that they'll let you... that they won't destroy your ship. But she hasn't received confirmation of that. It'll be risky. The consul sits back in the leather seat. He feels as if he has been hit by the neural stunner again. Negotiate? What the hell would I have to negotiate? Gladstone said that she would contact you via your ship's fat line once you're off Hyperion. This has to be done quickly, today, before all the first wave worlds fall to the swarms. The consul hears first wave worlds, but does not ask if his beloved Maui Covenant is amongst them. Perhaps he thinks it would be best if it were. He says, No, I'm going back to the valley. Theo adjusts his glasses. She won't allow that, sir. Oh? The consul smiles. How is she going to stop me? Shoot down my ship? I don't know, but she said that she wouldn't allow it. Theo sounds sincerely worried. The Force Fleet does have picket ships and torch ships in orbit, sir, to escort the last drop ships. Well, says the consul, still smiling, let them try to shoot me down. Manned ships haven't been able to land near the Valley of the Time Tombs for 2 centuries anyway. Ships land perfectly, but their crews disappear. Before they slag me, I'll be hanging on the Shrike's tree. The consul closes his eyes a moment and imagines the ship landing, empty, on the plain above the valley. He imagines Saul, Duray, and the others, miraculously returned, running for shelter in the ship, using its surgery to save Hetmastine and Braun Lamia, its cryogenic fugue and sleep chambers to save little Rachel. My God, whispers Theo, and the shocked tone slams the consul out of his reverie. They have come around the final turn in the river above the city. The bluffs rise higher here, culminating to the south in the carved mountain likeness of sad King Billy. The sun is just setting, igniting low clouds and buildings high on the eastern bluffs. Above the city, a battle is raging. Lasers lance into and through the clouds. Ships dodge like gnats and burn like moths too close to a flame, while parafoils and the blur of suspension fields drift beneath the cloud ceiling. The city of Keats is being attacked. The ousters have come to Hyperion. Oh, sweet fuck, Theo whispers reverently. Along the forested ridge northwest of the city, a brief spout of flame and a flicker of contrail mark a shoulder-launched rocket coming directly toward the hegemony's skimmer. Hang on, snaps Theo. He takes manual control, throws switches, banks the skimmer steeply to starboard, trying to turn inside the small rocket's own turning radius. An explosion aft throws the console into the crash web and blurs his vision for a moment. When he can focus again, the cabin is filled with smoke, red warning lights pulse through the gloom, and the skimmer warns of systems failure in a dozen urgent voices. Theo is slumped grimly over the Omni controller. "Hang on," he says again, needlessly. The skimmer slews sickeningly, finds a grip in the air, and then loses it as they tumble and sideslip toward the burning city.